morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. On the phone with me now to take a look at some of the development projects going on around Summit County, I have Community Development Director Pat Putt. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's talk about the construction at the base of the canyons this summer. I know that that was one of the reasons that kind of kicked it out for a venue for, well, the Park City Institute for one, but others as well, the farmers market. So what's tapped? I mean, that's pulling building permits.
Yeah, we are anticipating quite a bit of construction in the canyons base area. We have two big projects still under construction right now. The lift development, which is on RC-22, which is off a high mountain road. That is about 114,000 square feet, 60 units. The big project that's out there is on RC-25. That's in that same vicinity off a high mountain road. It's up above high mountain road. That's the Apex project. That's a little over 160,000 square feet of development there as well. I think the unit count is somewhere around 62 separate keys on that project. So those two projects in and of themselves are large construction, are two large construction projects. What are we seeing in addition to that? It's very likely that we're going to see two more multifamily or hotel projects get entitled this year, and if time frames work for the developer, we could see them begin construction later this year. The first of those are on a site that's called RC-14. That's as you're coming up Canyons Resort Drive, passing the Grand Summit underneath the Cabriolet. RC-14 is the micro hotel project. It's about 73,000 square feet. Don't hold me to the exact number of these rooms, but I think it's somewhere around 140 of those. The other project that we're going to have in front of the Planning Commission here very shortly is on RC-16. That's kind of tucked down in the sort of the southwest corner of the resort core off of Red Pine. RC-16 is 42 multifamily units. There's a project in the lower village on LV-10. That one's called White Pine Canyons Village. That's 30 multifamily units. And then finally, in the Frostwood area, on two parcels designated F4 and F8, there's 48,000 square feet potentially going to be built this year. So it would be undershooting the comment by saying, you know, we're going to have some work out in the Canyons area. We're going to have a lot of work in the Canyons area this summer.
What about the employee housing, the workforce housing? When does that get started?
Well, our hope is now that the documents have been, all the necessary documents are in the process of being signed and recorded, that we're going to be seeing the plans come in for that project this year. Will it begin in 2018? Maybe a little premature to speculate on that. If all goes well, we would like to see that begin construction, obviously, because it's a critical piece of not only the canyons, but sort of a broader strategy and, you know, community workforce employee housing. We see it as a potential success in terms of dealing with some of the traffic that's associated with loading our employees in and out of the canyons area. So we have not received an application yet, but we're waiting for that. I know it's coming.
Okay. What's up with the Blue Ribbon Kimball Junction Group?
Boy, where it is right now is literally on the wall of my office and on the computer in front of me right now. We, about a month back, went back to the committee and said, we think we're ready at a staff level to commit some of these concepts and ideas and imagery into some real, you know, some real words and some steps moving forward. The amount of time and energy from a staff perspective to complete the East Side zoning kind of took us off our work program a bit. With that behind us, you know, we're putting our energies towards that. And like I say, we're in the drafting mode right now. What we're trying to do is take roughly 10 principles, and on each one of those, start to describe what needs to happen and next and what we can do. And it's going to probably be a combination of a number of strategies. In some instances, it may involve some code changes. In some instances, it may involve the creation of some new processes. It may involve some specific projects that we're going to recommend be considered. They could be county projects. They could be working with UDOT to accomplish some of these. They may be private initiatives. In some cases, there may be the need for more refined additional studies in a couple of areas. So that's what we're doing right now. We're trying to put these down so we can go back to the Blue Ribbon Committee, refine that document, and begin the public process.
So when you talk about code changes, I mean, what are you talking about?
Code changes may be something like the creation of some new zones. There may be the need to create a mixed-use zone. If that tool, upon review by both the commission and the council and the public, doesn't seem to be the right approach, it may be going back and taking a look at existing zones that we have and updating those. It could be the community commercial zone. Could be the SPA process. So what we want to be able to do is first agree on what we would like to ultimately envision for those areas, where the intensities, the types of uses, and we believe they're going to be more mixed in nature. But visualizing them and agreeing on that is one thing, but being able to move forward and entitle those predictably through a process is another. Would our tools we have now work? Perhaps, but maybe not as well as we would want them and not necessarily achieve what we want. You know, we'd like to see some of this incentive-based to the degree we can, and that's what we want to go back with and talk with the group. We're anxious to kind of get this to a point where we can get more community and neighborhood input on it, and that's what we hope to achieve this summer.
Okay. Real quick, what do things stand with a safety crossing over or under 224? I know Basin Rec's been talking about that for years. It was something that was also brought up this week when council members heard about the strategic plan report and some of the comments from staff themselves.
Yeah. We've been talking about that, solving that problem of 224 for years now. Part of the Kimball Junction plan is the recognition that there are a number of moving pieces here. Critical to the success of the neighborhood in the future is going to be two things. One, somehow making the north-south traffic flow, we've been calling that the regional flow of 224, work better while at the same time improving the east-west connections. There's two critical principles that are in the plan that we're going to be fleshing out. The first is to create those safe, predictable east-west connections. A bridge is a possible, a tunnel is a possible idea. You know, the combination of those may be something we're going to be considering. The positive news is that we have met with representatives from UDOT who are interested in dusting off the corridor plan for 224 in the Kimball Junction area. They're waiting on us to complete this process so that we can begin to describe a bit more what it is that we would like to achieve before we begin that next separate process. We've heard that concern or that need expressed on a number of occasions. You know, we have a separated, divided, bifurcated neighborhood there, with two distinct areas that have commercial retail activities with some residential. we're likely to see the very likely possibility of more residential in there. The five-lane state highway dividing it is a barrier, and we think we can solve that. The best way, I think, remains to be seen. There's going to be costs associated with that, but we think that there are some viable solutions out there. Are they going to happen in the near term? I don't see we're going to see those happen in the next couple of years, but this plan's going to be the crucial first step to help describing what it is we want to see.
Okay, Pat, I need to leave it there. Talk to you next month. Thank you for your time.
All right.
KPCW News Time now, 8:22. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour here on KPCW. Well, Deer Valley is launching its inaugural concert series with 5 shows this summer. In the studio with details, I have Deer Valley Branding Director Colleen Burden, along with one of the concert promoters there, Darren Piccoli, also with State Room Presents. Is that accurate?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. Well, Colleen, first, let's just talk about the resort's decision to go on its own.
Sure.
This is what you've been working on here to bring 5 shows instead of 9?
Yeah, you know, there was a few reasons we did this. One was we wanted to brand a series as our own, and we've had a great relationship over the years with the State Room. They've assisted us with our World Cup concerts and presented at Deer Valley. And the other thing was the use of venue. You know, doing 10 shows on top of the Deer Valley Music Festival on top of the Wednesday night shows, we never had a chance to let the venue rest. And we really have been talking about this for 2 or 3 years and saying we want to become the premier venue in Utah in the mountains, right? We want to be that venue. And to do that, we just knew that we had to sort of take charge of our own destiny and have some skin in the game.
Yeah. So you kind of knew you wanted to work with these guys. I mean, it wasn't
we've
like you went out and put
an RFP
out or anything
yeah.
out. Yeah.
Because we've had a great relationship.
We've done several shows over the years at Deer Valley, I think starting with Jimmy Cliff and Michael Frante back in the day. And, you know, one thing we always gravitated to was creating this consistency up there. And obviously the way the symphony performs their events is pretty great. And they've developed a great brand over the years. And to expand on the idea of giving people something consistent throughout the summer was a driving force.
Okay. Yeah, and for us, it was really, too. It wasn't about any one promoter. It was about owning our venue. And so we would produce with sort of whoever showed up and wanted to produce. And we realized that that just really wasn't the best approach for the guests either. They didn't really understand whose series they were showing up to.
Yeah. So I guess, Darren, my question to you, I mean, who is your master here? I mean, because seems like we've got a bidding war between Deer Valley, Red Butte, what you do, and then, of course, your own venue, the State Room.
Right.
So who gets what, and how do you decide that?
Well, that's a good question. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of the venues are all different sizes. Chris and I, my business partner, have always believed in cultivation of artist and patron. So there's acts like, for example, this summer, there's an act coming that started at the State Room that didn't sell out the State Room and now is selling thousands of tickets. So we always appreciate this idea of cultivation and moving artists up the ladder and trying to give an experience that is somewhat consistent from the 300-seat State Room to a mid-sized venue to something larger. I think we as a State Room aren't personally involved with Red Butte, that kind of is its own, you know, machine that has developed over the years. And I believe Deer Valley has probably looked at that and said, you know, this is a great successful model. It's become something that people look forward to. Obviously, you have a lot of second home people here that probably will coordinate some summer trips based on what shows are happening.
Yeah. So you don't do the shows for Red Butte?
No.
I had heard that you did. Okay. So in terms of the shows, and let's kick it off. I mean, it doesn't start till August, nothing in July. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Was that just timing with the acts?
Yeah, the first year, timing with the acts, the idea to give the symphony, you know, their window and not have shows jammed in between. Again, back to that idea of kind of creating that consistency and putting a clear path out there for the first year.
Okay. Yeah. So when you went to put together the schedule, I mean, what did it was just who was available?
It's partially who's available, partially who we feel like would fit well into a curated series up here with the demographic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, obviously availability is a big
always,
deal.
Yeah, no okay. matter who you are. And just to clarify, so
Chris, my business partner.
Business partner.
Works for the University of Utah to book Red Butte concert series. But the State Room entity does not
does
book
not.
Red Butte.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks for that clarification.
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, well, then let's kick it off. I mean, Well, it just shows you my lack of pop culture. But the Decemberists, they're kicking it off.
Yeah, we're excited about that one.
Mm-hmm. If you go online, Leslie, and listen to them, you'll know who they are.
Yeah.
Okay.
They have a lot of popular hits. Great indie pop rock band. They've been growing over the years. They've played numerous sold-out shows throughout Utah, and we kick it off on Thursday, August 2nd, with the Decemberists and up-and-coming band Whitney.
Okay. And then we've got another Thursday show the following week.
Yep. Mm-hmm. We have Gavin DeGraw and Philip Phillips. Philip Phillips, former winner of American Idol, and had that huge hit, Home, I believe it was.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the name of it. And Gavin DeGraw, which is a great pop folk rock.
So Gavin's opening for Philip, or?
It's like a co-headline. Mm-hmm. So they will both be doing equal time sets. Philip will be going on first. Gavin will be closing the show.
Okay. And then you continue on the 18th.
And that's another co-headline bill on Saturday, August 18th, with Lucas Nelson and Promise of the Real and M Ward. And it's been a little while since M Ward's been in town. And Lucas Nelson was that band that started the Stateroom, selling 200 tickets.
Yeah, really. Is that Willie Nelson's son?
That is Willie Nelson's son. And Promise of the Real, his band, has been touring and has made 3 albums with Neil Young. So if you've heard any of the recent Neil Young music, that's his band, as well as him, backing him. So it's an amazing show. It's got this great southern rock country sound. He sounds like a young Willie, but he's got his own sound. It's pretty amazing.
Okay. And then August 31st with Government Mule.
Yep. Friday Night Mule Fest. They're doing a very special little Labor Day bash, 4 days around the West Coast, and we were lucky to get one of them. And the Magpie Salute is opening that show. That's Rich Robinson, one of the brothers from the Black Crowes, and a couple other former members of the Black Crowes. And we did a show with them at the Eccles Theater last year. It's a pretty amazing ensemble they have on stage. I think there's 5 or 6 guitars.
Really?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Wow.
And then it ends Labor Day.
Yep. We close it out on Monday with Jason Mraz, hugely popular. Mm-hmm. Kind of, he's got like a reggae tinge, bit of a acoustic. I compare him a bit to Jack Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is on September 3rd, Monday, Labor Day. So yeah, it's packed 5 shows within a month.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to see him. I was shut out of that really quick
at
Red Butte last year. Yeah, but in terms of how you are gonna to work with us, I mean, when you think about people like Ben Harper, the Avett Brothers, yeah. Chris Isaak, I mean, those are big acts that could easily fill
absolutely
Deer Valley. I mean, because you can't even buy a ticket at Red Butte,
right?
I guess unless you want to buy a scalp ticket, but. So is that something that you and Chris will be working on to see where things fit best?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's really great, the similarities, but you also are mm-hmm. quite unique. I mean, you're up in the mountains. You can get out of the heat. You have a whole nother group in Summit County, Heber and Camas and a lot of different and even really down into Provo and American Fork. I mean, when you think about the geographic location of Deer Valley, it opens itself up to a larger audience.
It does, Leslie. And I think one of the benefits of working with these guys and being a part of it is, kind of the Deer Valley marketing machine, if you will. We have, a communications team, a brand team, a digital team, and all of those things will really help play into the reach on our concerts and even selling concert lodging. I mean, it's what a great weekend, right? You come up, you go to a show, you play on Main Street. So...
when do tickets go on sale?
May 11th at 10 a.m.
May 11th is the public on sale, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Don't need to buy a membership or anything.
Nope.
Just go online. Is that the best way to do it?
Yeah, you can go to DeerValleyConcertSeries.com.
Mm-hmm.
You can also go to DeerValley.com and to the events, and you'll get linked there as well.
Okay. Yeah. And then tickets just range in prices depending on the act?
Yep, exactly.
Okay. And it looked like the show times may start earlier than normal.
They're a little earlier because it's such a great lineup with opening acts. And
yeah, what we found was, that some of these acts and agents for them were genuinely excited to be part of this new series. And, I'm sure some of the agents have worked over the years at the Mountain. So a lot of the shows kind of turned into these co-headlines. So the Philip, Gavin DeGraw. So now you're getting a lot more music and the M Ward and Lucas Nelson. So that's why some of those shows have moved the doors earlier so that, in essence, you're getting more music.
Right.
So it's not a 75-minute show. It's a 120-minute show.
Great. Okay. What else do people need to know?
I think just, yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, we'll be updating information on DeerValleyConcertSeries.com, so that's probably the best place to go to just get any additional information.
Exactly.
I think people will like the choices of tickets out there. What we've done in the past for our own shows that we've done there is a separation of kind of a standing room GA area and then some reserve seating and then also additional GA. So it creates a really fun vibe up front for the band. So there'll be three different ticketing options for people.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think those levels will really play to the community in different, yeah.
Right, right. So, I mean, would the general admission seats or chairs then be the same price? It's just the...
No.
There'll be like the large general admission lawn, and then there'll be reserved seats, and then there'll be a GA floor, if you will, in front of the stage. So the front two areas will typically be similarly priced, and then the lawn will be less expensive.
We like to call it kind of the premium GA. So they're up front with the band. They can dance. They're close. And for those who want to sit, there's seats behind.
I think that'll be a welcome
Thank you.
Change. Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Well, thanks for your time, you guys.
Thanks, Leslie.
Darren and Colleen. Well, the Park City Council got its first look at next year's budget, totaling more than $74 million. In the studio with a recap of that and other issues, Councilmember Steve Joyce, good morning.
Good morning.
So it seems like a huge amount for a town of 8,000 people.
Yeah, we always get into the discussion of, but we're really not a town of 8,000 people. By the time you throw in, you know, three quarters of our houses are second homeowners. We always have a constant tourist business. And, you know, certainly at our peak with things like Sundance and President's Week and things like that, we've got, you know, really more of a town of 60,000 or something more similar to that. And so the level of service we have to provide is a lot of times it's really up at that 60,000 level, not at the 8,000 or 9,000 level.
Yeah. And I guess, I mean, when you start talking about that kind of money, it seems like, boy, if we'd been better savers, we'd be able to buy treasure outright.
You know, the funny thing is you're literally not allowed to save much here by state law. This just confounds me because we talk about being a state that's very, very fiscally sound. And you can't put more than 25% of your general fund away. And I guess the intent of that was around somebody just taxing really heavily and just piling the money away. But yeah, you really can't stockpile it.
Yeah. So of course we get money through sales tax, franchise fees, and the property taxes. But sales tax is actually the big one, yeah?
Yeah. And part of that, if you go back and look, sales tax and property tax used to be just about exactly equal. Property tax, people think about it going up. The only time it really goes up is either when you have some sort of an election to decide to raise your property taxes, or you actually add something like the bond, like we did with Bonanza. Sales tax goes up both inflationary and just as we have more people in town buying more things. The property tax has stayed pretty flat, so sales tax has become more and more important.
Yeah, so any concerns then because of maybe not such a great ski season this last winter?
So far so good. I'm actually the liaison with the chamber, the city council's liaison to the chamber, and the numbers for the winter were amazingly good considering the snow that we had. And I think we'll see as we get the taxes. We tend to lag about 2 months behind on when a quarter closes versus knowing what we actually did. But I don't think we had a bad year fiscally for lodging, restaurants, anything.
Yeah. And, you know, we haven't had a tax increase, a property tax increase, but we have certainly seen sales taxes go up for transit and transportation, open space, capital improvements. We have a carbon offset fee. We have a stormwater fee. We have increased building fees. So, you know, you can say, oh, we haven't raised taxes, but you really have raised fees.
Oh, no, I didn't say it. I just said property taxes.
Yeah, but I mean, to the homeowner, there is no difference.
Right.
I mean, it's just it's more expensive to live here.
It certainly is. I would offer that there really is kind of a difference. If you look at things like sales tax, of who's paying for it? When you look at property tax, it's, you know, what they say roughly 10% business, 15% local, and 75% second homeowners. When you get to sales tax, it's actually almost completely tourists and second homeowners. I mean, I think the number was 93 or 95%, something like that. So depending on what you tax, stormwater, well, that only hits people who own houses here. So it really, even though the taxes go up and it is more expensive, certainly it has different impacts. Transient room tax, which is what we're using for the arts district, that's all people staying in hotels and has no impact on locals at all.
Let's see. Special events, level of engagement. Council wanted to know where the survey is. What survey? I mean, we did a survey a couple of years ago.
Yeah. We formed SEAC a couple of years ago, trying to get people's feelings about events when we started hearing more and more about event fatigue, where people are just feeling kind of overrun by events in town. SEAC has done a nice job of, just kind of staying in touch with friends and people in the community. But at some point, we think that we're really ready to go back out and try to get input from 1,000 people instead of, SEAC's, 5 or 7 members and their friends kind of thing. It's like we really want to get something that's more measured and much broader, because I think we're at a point where we're going to have to start making some changes, and we're not completely confident that we have the real feeling of how the locals are reacting.
Yeah. I mean, council seemed, it's concerned that the survey hadn't been done, and yet you heard from members of SEAC, it's like, well, you guys got to give us some policy. So, I mean, yep. We're going to survey what? I mean, that's the thing. It's like maybe we should have some policy decisions made so that people can give you some input about it.
Yeah, I completely agree. We've got, we certainly have to nail some things down, but there's really kind of two separate pieces. The policy is kind of driven on, how we really see events playing into the economy and into our local vibrancy and, as a draw for tourists here. And we need to have policies around, are we trying to fill the shoulder season? That was really, special events used to be an economic driver to try to take those huge drops where the businesses had to lay off their employees and everything for April and May and then try to load back up for July and August. But the question is, people seem to value their shoulder season, and that's the kind of thing that I don't think is a policy we want to set without specifically going back and asking the locals. The easy question, if you had what you've got today and you were going to add one big event, would you rather kind of pile on to the already busy summer and protect your shoulders, or would you rather put it out in the shoulder where there's not as much stuff going on? And, we're kind of looking for some impact on that. We could decide based on the, 5 city council members and the mayor, but I don't think that's really what we want to do. So I think we're going to have to get a little bit more information from the public, and then we'll start putting some stronger policies in place.
Yeah. How do you lean on that, though? I mean, would you rather have the shoulder seasons to yourself?
I think it was interesting. I got some numbers from the chamber on how our occupancy rates have changed over the last, 7 years. And the shoulders really are starting to fill in. The one that stunned me was September is now the same as August. I mean, I used to, when I moved here 14 years ago, it's like come Labor Day, kids went back to school, town kind of closed down for a little bit. Literally now September is not close to August, it is August. And so in October's not quite the same, but it's doubled in the last 7 years from a hotel occupancy rate. So we really have filled in the shoulders quite a bit. And so I lean towards, really kind of protecting that shoulder season. But quite frankly, it comes back to it's not my decision. I just need to kind of do what our local constituents want to see done.
Okay, with the Big Star Bright Nights application, big show of support for Executive Director Terry Orr, everyone showing up, from Sundance to KPCW. I think some concerns, though, with the venue right next to the hospital, that there could be some safety concerns.
Yeah. One of the things that I didn't realize until yesterday was that we actually have to, for this event, at that event venue, well, it's not really a venue, we're going to make it into a venue, we actually have to get a UDOT sign off for these, because when you turn around and start bringing lots and lots of people for either load in or load out, it tends to actually flow out onto 40. And so now you've got two state highways, 40 and 248, where you're having an event that's creating a traffic, a traffic jam, basically, or has the potential of it. And with the hospital down there in particular, there's a lot of concerns if everything's all backed up and you really can't get into Quinn's Junction and now the ambulance is coming with somebody, now what? And it's not like it can't be solved. It's just we need a good plan, and then UDOT has to sign off on it before it's real.
So staff is thinking that the item will come back to council about June 7th. I mean, that cuts it pretty darn close, no?
We're trying to get it done sooner, but quite frankly, I mean, we're just not in a position. I think what you heard, had you been there, what you would have heard last night was a lot of support, not only from the audience and from other nonprofits and things, but from city council. I mean, we've been pushing pretty hard and from staff to try to make this happen. I mean, this is It's awkward. It's not an event place that I don't. I know Terry wouldn't really prefer it. We would rather not have it there. There's no transit. It's not set up for things. There's lots of other events that are going to require takedown of the, you know, the bandstand kind of thing. So it's going to take a lot of work. And because we're responsible, when we sign off and say yes, what we're saying is you've got an adequate plan for traffic. You've got an adequate plan for health safety issues and things like that. Addressing things like the ambulances getting into the hospital, noise disturbances for the community. We really can't sign off. I mean, I appreciate that Terry wants a definitive answer, but we really can't vote a final yes until we can, you know, see all that stuff. I mean, we have a responsibility to the community just like we do to somebody trying to throw an event.
Okay. Steve, anything else you want to mention?
No, it's just a busy night, but it was a lot of little stuff, and I was glad to see everything move forward. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your time. Park City Council Member Steve Joyce. It's 8:44. Good morning. Well, after covering the athletes of the U.S. ski team for more than 30 years, and many of those right here on KPCW, Tom Kelly leaves his position as Vice President of Communications for U.S. Ski and Snowboard next month. He joins me now in the studio for final time in that capacity. Good morning to you, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie. And it may be the final in this capacity, but I know I'll be back, so don't worry, folks.
So you officially leave June 15th. Has that kind of sunk in yet?
You know, it's getting there. I'm in the phase where I'm wondering now, okay, who's going to write that next check after June 15th? And I know that's going to come, but it's been a four-year transition plan. It's the third time I've attempted to leave the organization. And when Tiger Shaw came on as CEO 4 years ago, I decided I'd re-up for another 4 years, and I told Tiger I'd love to work with you through 2018, but that's it. I want to, at some point in my career, spread my wings and broaden my scope to cover more Olympic sports. I'll still stay very close to ski and snowboard, but it's been a four-year transition. It's been great, and it will end on June 15th.
Yeah, so in terms of that, who's going to show up in that seat next November?
Well, we have to talk about that. We have some ideas that we want to run by you, and I certainly want to continue to do things, but not in the capacity representing U.S. Ski and Snowboard. My successor, more or less, is a young man. He'll like that. A gentleman by the name of Tom Webb. Tom has moved us for about 6 months now as Director of Marketing and Communications, and I've just had an absolute blast working with him. He's super knowledgeable. He brings in 20 years of Formula One motorsports experience, worked at America's Cup, and he's just brought a really fresh look. I think that's really important. I've been here a long time, and I'm proud of what I've done, and I'm particularly proud of how I have evolved with the job and with the communications marketplace as it has changed so dramatically, particularly in the last 10 years. But Tom brings a fresh perspective, and I think people will enjoy working with him, and he's certainly gotten his feet wet the last 6 months.
Great. Well, of course, you have a familiar voice to many. After how many reports or how many years here on KPCW, I guess you kind of came with the station.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I haven't added up how many reports I've probably done, but you could probably do the math on it because it has been 30 years that I've been sitting in the seat, and figure that I've probably done 20 of those a year. So that's 600 if my math is correct. But, you know, I want to relate my very first time. I had moved over here in the spring of 1988 when U.S. Ski Association moved over from Colorado Springs. And I'd been to Park City once before, and I'd also done what I called small town radio for years and years. So I walked into the station up on Marsac and sat down in front of this guy, Blair Fulner, and I was just totally ready to handle this. And right out of the chute, man, he just came right at me with these really tough questions that I had never thought I was going to get asked. And it was a rough start. And I, from that day forward, I said, okay, I'm going to pay attention because this is not your typical small town radio station. And you know, with what Blair did in starting the station and what you've done as news director, you guys do bring out all of the issues. So, you know, as I tell people, if you're going on KPCW, you got to go in prepared.
Now what?
So what I want to do is I want to stay in the Olympic world, and I've just loved the Olympics. It goes back to a day when I was 7 years old, and Mom put the TV on in Madison, Wisconsin, and I watched skiing from Squaw Valley in the Olympics, and I was just hooked on the Olympics. So I want to broaden out and work in Olympic sports. Two things, really. I'm opening my Tom Kelly Communications LLC, and I'll be doing consulting work in communications, public relations, and content management for other Olympic sports organizations. I'll do some with U.S. Ski ski and snowboard, and that could include national governing bodies, small clubs or large clubs, international federations, whatever it might be. I have a few clients set up right now, and I expect to have some more. My real passion, though, is in my public speaking under the Behind the Gold banner. I'll continue that and expand it, and I want to bring Olympians along with me and maybe create an Olympics Athlete Speakers Bureau, but give them more opportunities to present themselves. And it's a real passion of mine, and I've been talking to a lot of folks. So when I was back at the Team USA Awards in Washington, D.C. last week, I spent a lot of time talking to athletes from other sports in the U.S. Olympic Committee about that, and it's a great deal of enthusiasm for it out in the marketplace.
Yeah, and you're also going to stay with the Ski Museum and also with the Ski Hall of Fame?
Yeah, way? So I'm presently the chair of the National U.S. Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame. That chairmanship ends this April, and I'll turn the reins over to David Enjamy, who used to head the SIA organization. I'll still stay involved with the National Hall of Fame, but my five-year tenure as chairman will end. But I came on as chair of the Alfhanged Ski Museum Foundation board last fall. I'll continue that. That's a real passion of mine. And I'm definitely, we're staying in Park City. We built a barn last year. We love where we are, and we plan to stay right here. My main initiative here is just to expand my skills to use them across a broader range of Olympic sports and also get out of the need to go into an office every day and really be more independent on what I do. And it's really been quite exciting so far.
Well, when you think about all of the folks you have met over the last 30 years, I mean, you had said you wanted to spend just a couple of minutes talking about some of the athletes who have made an impression on you. And kind of when I looked at this list, it's like they're all women.
Well, yeah, I threw this list down, but you know, the fact is that's where we've really had our strength over the years. I want to kick it off though and just talk about Bodie, because Bodie is really in a class all by himself. And I was thinking as I built this list what each of these athletes represented, and Bodie represents something really special. He just was a completely unique athlete. There was nothing comparative from him to anybody else, and he just did his own thing. He was very independent and really crafted his own way. And in particular, I remember being with him at the night race at Schladming in 2002, just before the Salt Lake Olympics, where he won in front of 75,000 people. And it was just pretty remarkable. He is truly an example of a global hero. You know, the first really big hero that I was connected with was Peekaboo Street, and she still remains one of those who are really closest to me. You know, people think about what Lindsey Vonn's done in winning 80-plus World Cups. Peekaboo won 13 World Cups in her career, and we thought that that was as good as it gets. And I remember when she won the World Cup downhill title in 1995 and being in Bormio with her for that awards presentation. You know, we had no idea where it was going to take us, but Peekaboo really started that. Hannah Carney, who I actually just did a speaker panel with a week ago at the Governor's Economic Summit, she'll be graduating from college at Westminster next week. And what I really remember about her is her passion for winning. I mean, nobody was more focused on winning than Hannah Carney. And it was great to be with her when she won her gold medal in 2010 in Vancouver. And it was also great to be with her when she cried through an entire press conference for finishing third. Just the disappointment of not winning, and all of us looking, well, you won the bronze medal, but that wasn't her goal. Just the focus that she brought was quite amazing. You know, Lindsey Vonn has just set a completely new level. It is what she's accomplished is just second to none. She is now squarely focused on the Stenmark goal. So I think this next season you will see her probably talk a little bit less about racing the men and more about the Stenmark record. She's so focused on that now because she got within striking distance last year. Last evening I was with Keegan Randall, and Keegan got her start here in 2002 at the Olympics. She didn't really do that well, but she was motivated to really do something for her sport. I mean, she essentially is the complete reason for the success of that women's team, and just unselfish. One of the awards she got last night was the Buddy Werner Award for sportsmanship, and she, to me, just epitomizes the perfect athlete who it's not just about them, it's about everything around them. You know, and Jesse Diggins, too, being a cross-country fan, is someone who's you know, just going to take where Keegan left off and just rise up from there. I'm going to throw one more in, and then I'll wrap it up with my last athlete on the list that you have. But I need to do a shout-out for Tommy Moe, because what he accomplished in Lillehammer in 1994 and being in that finish area when he won that gold medal in the downhill. Nobody expected that. Absolutely nobody. And he came through, and that's the American way. You know, that's what we've done. But the final athlete I want to talk about this morning is Kelly Clark. And I was really proud a week ago that Kelly was the one who gave me the USOC Building Dreams Award in Washington. And what I like about Kelly, whose career started right here in Park City when she won gold in 2002, she went to five Olympics, never finished lower than fourth, was fourth twice, which is the worst place to be. I was with her for all five of those medals, and I was with her for those two fourth-place finishes. It's gut-wrenching when you finish fourth, and particularly in Pyeongchang when she got beat by a teammate for the bronze medal. And that teammate was like, oh, I didn't want to beat Kelly, you know, but it's competition. What Kelly did that day was really quite remarkable. She was the first to congratulate her teammates in the finish. And that evening when we actually honored Kelly, Chloe Kim presented her with an award. Kelly said something that I think just really sums up what I like to see in these Olympic athletes. And she said, if your dreams only include yourself, if your dreams only include yourself, your dreams are not big enough. And I think as I look back to the athletes that I've been closest to, it's those that really valued what the sport is about and what they could bring to it, not what they brought to it for themselves.
So quite a career, Tom Kelly. Probably have you back on Mountain Money once you launch the the new. But it's been a pleasure. A winter Monday mornings with you.
Well,
I've been in this seat, so
it really has, and I'm going to miss it. And for all of you who recognize my voice in the shopping line at Smith's and say hi, I really appreciate that. Please come up and say that again, and I'll find a way to get back into this seat and do some stories beyond ski and snowboard as well. So thank you very much, and thanks to all the listeners.
Okay, good luck to you.
Thanks.
Tom Kelly. Well, the Kimball Arts Center presenting its annual Wasatch-backed student art show. It opened in the gallery last week. In the studio with details, I have the curator of the event, Nancy Stokes. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so tell us what you've got on display.
So right now we have the Wasatch-backed student art show on display. This year's theme is art and the environment, and more than 1,000 students from our community participated in making work for this show this year. It's a really incredible show filled with creativity and just a really inspiring display of student work.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have 1,000 pieces in there?
So there's more than 950 pieces, and a few of those are group projects. And so the total, comes to over 1,000. And it's great to see so much of our community reflected in this show.
Yeah, because I think you opened it up to Summit, Wasatch, South
Absolutely.
Summit.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have students from 12 different schools who participated. Absolutely, from South Summit to many schools from here in Park City and all over.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, the theme, you do that every year. To what? Give the art teachers some kind of opportunity to kind of direct their students?
Absolutely. I think the theme makes it fun for the show to come together around a certain idea. But the teachers and the students take it in so many different directions through their own experience and their creativity. And so it's really beautiful to see the many directions within a theme that they can go.
Yeah, it's hard to do on the radio, and people should really just stop by themselves. It's
they
free.
They absolutely need to. It's free. The Kimball's open every day. The show is open through May 27th. And I think you'll walk into this exhibition and really find pieces that you'll be thinking about throughout the day and throughout the week, and it's just a really powerful show.
Yeah, give us a description of maybe a couple of the pieces.
It's so hard. There's so many favorites to talk about, but there's a great group of robots that are talking about each individual's carbon footprint. And so students are taking garbage and kind of creating these recycled robots out of recycled materials, or a great group of photographs that are juxtaposing plastic with the natural environment in really interesting ways. There's a beautiful painting where a figure is lifting up the ocean and like it's a rug and it's revealing plastic underneath it. And then there's just so many beautiful studies of our local landscape and the environment around us, and really celebrating the beauty that we have here in Utah.
Yeah, and I'm guessing all mediums. I mean, we've got ceramics and drawing and painting.
Absolutely. There's such a diversity of mediums. There's exactly just as you said. And it's fun to see that.
Yep. Sometimes the art is for sale. That's up to the student to decide whether or not they want to part with it?
Actually, in this case, it's not for sale. Since since it's the student art show this year. Mm-hmm. We do have a great show in the Cafe Gallery by Mark Crenshaw, and those pieces are for sale.
Okay. Again, the Kimball is open every day?
Every day. We're open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday and 12 p.m. to 5 p.m. on Saturday and Sunday.
Okay. Anything else, Nancy, you'd like to tell us?
No, it's a great show, and don't miss it. I really hope you come by.
Okay. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Nancy Stokes, again, the curator of this year's annual Wasatch Back Student Art Show. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW.